to reach Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
You know, the old saying about rats deserting a sinking ship is absolutely true. They do that, of course, before the ship actually goes down. Even a rat tries to get to the air and jumps for his life. Well, there's a lot of that going on right now. If you want to see the latest, go to my website at www.artbell.com and decide for yourself. Sometimes the very best proof comes from the mouth of the person who made the original statement, and I'll leave it at that. But the information's on my website right now. At www.artbell.com. First item in the headlines. Check it out. Coming up in a moment, Kevin Ryerson. He's one of our nation's greatest intuitives. And I'll tell you more about Kevin in a moment. It's going to be an extremely interesting night. He's an acclaimed author. He's an award-winning consultant. He is an expert intuitive and trance channel in the tradition of Edgar Cayce and Jane Roberts. He's been lecturing, teaching in the field of parapsychology and spirituality for 27 years now, has been a guest on all kinds of national TV shows, including Oprah Winfrey, Good Morning America, and so forth and so on, is the author of the landmark book, Spirit Communication, The Soul's Path, Shirley MacLaine's best-selling books out, On a Limb, Dancing in the Light, and it's all in the playing, highlighted Kevin's intuitive abilities. He was both a consultant and talent in the ABC television series Out on a Limb. You remember that? His abilities are also featured in the 10th Insight, Holding the Vision. And it goes on and on and on. So here is Kevin Ryerson. Most people probably already know you, Kevin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bart.
Great to have you back. Kevin, any sense of what the hell's going on in the world? I mean, we have kids killing kids. We've got schools closing. We've got corn that has been modified that now is going to do in the monarch butterfly. We've got ecological disasters going on all over the place. Something's going on out there beyond the usual. We've got you said you heard the pilot, the first officer that I talked with quite extensively before the top of the hour. There's something going on, Kevin.
There is, Art, and people are wondering, like, if there's any one single thing that can be done, you know, to put context on, you know, this whole series of events as we sort of, like, rush towards the millennium.
Right.
As a person who's been a futurist and who studied prophecy and prediction from Edgar Cayce to Nostradamus, these times have been spoken of rather thoroughly, you know, within the context of prophecy and prediction. And actually, there are a number of core resolutions on any one of these numbers of different crises that we could concentrate on. In other words, there are resolutions there.
Well, no one thing caused it, so I would presume no one thing would fix it.
I don't think there's any one thing, you know, that we could put there's no one universal panacea. But there are some rather interesting undercurrents to a lot of the issues that I think that your program quite intriguingly raises, per se. And might be interesting to discuss some of those. Some of those resolutions you actually speak to right here on the show, which I think people, when I talk to them about your show, they get excited about those things. And it's these times, for instance, that Jung had spoke to. C.G. Jung, the great psychologist, had monitored people's dreams collectively and really became quite horrified as to what he was seeing in the 20s and the 30s in their dream states. They were having almost Kafka-like dreams.
Dreams of catastrophes and natural disasters and what?
Dreams of humanity almost, one classic dream was humanity almost cannibalizing itself, of which he then came to the conclusions with the political scenarios of the 30s that indeed we were approaching a Second World War. After the Second World War, he began monitoring the dream states again, and his conclusions were that we were very much headed into times that we are just now beginning to scratch the surface of.
Tell me something. Does that imply some sort of collective consciousness? Is that what we're talking about here? I mean, shared dreams?
I think it specifically speaks to the issue of collective consciousness. And it's not unusual for people who are still in touch with the collective unconscious to share co-dreaming, as it's called. And the idea that a community shares a common fate, that no person really is an island, that we're separated somehow, that we're separated from each other. And even if we were islands, we'd still have the hundredth monkey effect, where behavior on all the different islands would more or less adapt to the collective conscious. And one of the final statements that Jung came up with that is both hopeful and yet a little foreboding at the same time is that he said, the collective dreaming seems to reveal that humanity is headed to a period of time where there will be a crisis, possibly in technology, more than likely in the ecology, which will perhaps for the first time hopefully unite humanity to have a crisis that may take them beyond war. But if not, it could be the final revelations that are often spoken of in almost in a biblical context. And I feel that we are in those times.
In other words, we've entered the zone of the beginning of the changes. Is it irreversible? I mean, don't soft soap anything for me. I'm asking for your personal conclusions. Do you think that it has entered the irreversible, can't turn around anymore point?
Well, I think that some of the language of physics describes it rather nicely. There's the description of the black hole where gravity is so intense not even light can escape it. And we have entered what you might refer to as sort of the event horizon.
The event horizon.
And it's, in more street language, it's the idea that perhaps we're beginning to circle the drain is what it boils down to. But, also the interesting thing about that is although nothing escapes the black hole, the theory is that light does pass through. And comes out the other side as something new.
That's what we have to hope for, right?
I think so. And it could be that the only way out is in here, in this particular case, to actually embrace these whole series of crises. And I think the thing that's the most disturbing of all is, as you say, if Y2K has suddenly disappeared.
Isn't that odd? I mean, January 1st of 99, it began on CNN at the stroke of midnight. Boy, there were more Y2K stories, and Carter had little liver pills. And then it just went on and on and on, and then boom, like an axe, somebody cut it all off. Now, does that mean that all the worries are now not worries, everything has been solved, and everything is just spiffy, or does it mean they have concluded that to not exacerbate the problem, it is now time to stop talking about it, because those who are going to prepare have already done so, and those who haven't, it's too late.
I think it borders on the second perspective. It's very typical of the government that once an issue has defined itself per se, once they begin to realize perhaps the extent of it, they have a tendency to clamp down on the information or try to control the information. And so therefore, it's a little bit the classic ostrich effect. If you don't talk about it, maybe it won't be as bad. Or it's not really trusting the citizenry's full capacity to simulate the impact of what Y2K and these phenomena may be, and then quite frankly be able to do something about it, not within a governmental context, but within an individualist context.
Well, I think our government also is disinclined to not discuss and talk about something they have no control over. In other words, if something really is going to happen, they can't do anything about it, what good does it do for them to discuss it?
True. And it doesn't encourage an open dialogue on the idea that there could indeed be resolutions out there.
Well, if we have children picking up guns and killing other children, which we surely have a lot of these days, then if you can't do anything about it, pass a law against a thing, a gun. And so that's what they do. And they can't really affect behavior. They really can't affect a person's behavior. So instead, they legislate against the only thing around that can't talk back, and that's a gun.
Well, I think you're coming down to like one of the clearest, most comprehensive issues that I think is crucial in our society. Also speaking, you know, such phenomenology of you know, collective unconscious, et cetera, because the tendency of these copycat killings, I think, reflect more a collective consciousness rather than merely some type of collective pent-up frustration, for instance, finally having a model, you know, to give an outlet to it.
Oh, that's a really unique observation.
And I think one of the real key underpinnings here is that I think that we as a society have really lost touch with what I would refer to in my language as the psychic underpinnings of the psychic forces that lead up to what we refer to as this type of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Within our psychological paradigm, I think they're getting closer to the truth with what they refer to now is that, in particular, the school systems, that there is a crisis in the lack of the exercise of what we refer to as our emotional intelligence. That we have lost track of the ability of empathy or to the ability to feel what is real to us.
And is this because of some sort of circuit overload? In other words, the media delivering daily doses of... It's kind of like, I think, violence and, I am told, pornography. In other words, It's addictive to the point where it's finally numbing, and additional amounts are required to feed the sick mind. Is that what's happening to us?
I think you can suggest that that is an element of it, but I think it runs even deeper than that because it goes into the very foundations of what we consider to be the philosophical exponents as to what constitutes thinking itself. There was an article written that to me summarizes it very well. It's what's referred to as Descartes' error. Descartes was the famous philosopher who formed the fundamental philosophies of thinking and is most noted for his quote, "I think, therefore I am." So therefore, here you have the very underpinnings of the contemporary model as to what human existence is. But Descartes, in his philosophy, basically went to extraordinary extremes in trying to establish objectivity. He eliminated the fundamental underpinnings of emotional thinking or emotional values, literally the ability to feel one's own reality. In other words, cut away at the very core or the underpinnings of what we might call empathy, the ability to appreciate the reality of other human beings' value in our lives. And that permeates virtually every element of the scientific paradigm, every element of our educational model, and every problem-solving institution in our society. In other words, we have cultivated an entire generation of human beings who value deconditioning themselves with the ability to feel, to claim an objectivity that probably doesn't exist.
Well, it's also, on the part of the individual human, kind of a protective mechanism in the brain, isn't it? In other words, we're bombarded with all this incredibly awful, inexplicable information, like the shootings and so forth. And I guess after a while, we become, A, numbed to it, and B, we kind of block it out because it's just too much to contemplate. And as you point out, the empathy factor goes down with each new occurrence, and it's sort of a self-perpetuating process that seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. In other words, here comes the event horizon.
Mm-hmm.
You can already feel the ship beginning to accelerate into the hole.
Well, it's like you can begin to think of it as an emotional black hole is what it boils down to. It's almost to the point where it is so numbing that people feel that either as individuals or even collectively with their neighbors, there is not much they can do about it, so therefore they disassociate. And yet, in trying to understand it, it appears the underpinnings of the only information resources we have is the media, and all they do is constantly replay the more horrific elements. In other words, if it bleeds, it leads.
I know. If it bleeds, you're right. If it bleeds, it leads. Well said. Now, this brings up the experiments that I've done on the air. I've done quite a large series of experiments of mass concentration with incredible, inexplicable results, changing the weather, causing cures in people, asking my audience by the millions, and they have participated, to try and affect an outcome. In fact, Kevin, it worked so well that it began to scare me, and kind of like the scientists who are screwing around with the corn right now, and I see they're going to knock off the monarch butterfly, something they did not anticipate as a result of this genetically altered corn. I'm a little afraid to experiment with this kind of thing, because I really, frankly, don't know what the hell I'm doing. Now, it appears to be true that you can get many minds, if there is a collective consciousness, then there should be a collective ability to affect what is going to happen or what is happening. And it would appear to be true, but I'm afraid to toy with it. It's kind of like toying with a corn. I'm afraid of it. Should I not be?
I think that you should be open to the good that can be done with such a phenomenology, Art. It's like anything else. For instance, when the book The Mind Factor was published, and it created the phenomenology of the harmonic convergence, and millions of people around the planet in 1987, August 16th and 17th, went to the great sacred sites, whether it was Stonehenge or the pyramids, or whether it was Mayan pyramids or Machu Picchu.
That's right.
What was predicted is that 3.5 years later, an extraordinary opportunity to alter the course of humanity as it conceived itself, in other words, as we had entered into a groupthink, would occur. And 3.5 years later to the day, the Berlin Wall came down. And there was the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. There had been things like bloodless coups, for instance, you know, in Haiti, et cetera, et cetera.
That's true.
Now, what humanity does to do what I refer to as maintenance the peace, to wage the peace.
Wage the peace. We're waging the peace now.
Exactly. Mm. What humanity does to wage the peace is collectively up to them. Now, whether they look at this as just sort of like, you know, some event like a rock concert where everybody just kind of leaves, goes home, and there's just a bunch of empty bleachers, or whether this becomes a permanent value in their lives, the way it was in many of these ancient holistic cultures, of which we could learn a lot about this phenomenon by looking at them, remains to be seen. But the harmonic convergence does come up in many social studies now as a way in which humanity might be able to not just only offset some of these terrible consequences that are obviously been set in motion.
Yes.
But might be an incredibly powerful way to indeed be able to reach a greater potential for itself.
All right. Hold it right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. And we will be right back. I'm Art Bell. Mama told me all this when I was young.
Mama said there'll be days like this, there'll be days.
Coast to Coast AM.
Mama said there'll be days like this, there'll be days like this, my mama said. Mama said there'll be days like this. I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me.
in the Kingdom of Nye from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
That would be us. Joseph from Los Angeles has sent a very interesting fax for Kevin. Very interesting. And we'll ask about it in a moment. Kevin Ryerson is my guest. Oh, by the way, for Paula Marie in Kansas City, who sent me a copy of 7 Days. Dear, I did get it. Thank you. That's the one where they have the Art Bell character, except he had another name. 7 Days is about time travel, and apparently they profiled me, sort of, in last week's show. I'll get to watch it when I get off the air, but it did arrive. Thank you very much. Stay right where you are. Kevin Ryerson will be right back. Kevin Ryerson, once again, and Kevin, somebody writes to me a pretty intelligent piece. They wrote this to the LA Times as well, and it says, loophole in gun control laws. The loophole in gun control is that the government itself is permitted to produce and use guns and bombs of all kinds and sizes to train youth to use them against people and the environment, and to order, reward, and even attempt to justify their use. Government preachments about youth violence are fine, but unfortunately for us, all governments' violent examples count for more. And, of course, we could add the bombing for peace that's going on right now. Latest miss was hit a hospital, I think, over there in Belgrade. But it is true, is it not, that our government is, I guess, an example. That's what we see on TV every night, right?
Well, I think that... All right, I don't think you have to go any further. There's some interesting statistics. One of the largest suppliers of guns to people who use them for violence, including drug dealers, et cetera, is when the police confiscate weaponry. Quite often, they've been notorious for holding auctions with those weapons.
And sell them back.
Go directly back onto the street.
I know.
And then all of this is just, all these funds are just used to supply to start the whole cycle all over again. And it almost would be a comedy if it didn't have such tragic consequences. And the thing that's startling about that is, it's like M. Scott Peck wrote a book called The People of the Lie. And you were talking about the presidential nose a little earlier before everyone.
Actually, the engorgement of noses of those who lie, apparently scientifically now proven.
It's intriguing, you know. It sounds like the title of a good opera, you know, The Engorgement of the Nose.
Well, how many times have you seen our president, aside from his hair changing color, I mean, when he addresses senior citizens, it's total gray.
Mm.
When he's on TV addressing the nation, it tends toward the blonde.
Mm.
And his nose as well, there is no question about his nose. He reaches up and touches it. And it gets kind of red.
He does. You know, he's always struck me, even in the earliest part of his career, as looking a little bit like, you know, something halfway between Charlton Heston and W.C. Fields. You know,
there is another side to this, Kevin. On the one hand, you know, President Clinton has not really been that awful. Frankly, in a lot of ways, he's been an okay president in the duties of the presidency, and he shepherded us through a good economy and all the rest of it. All that really has happened to his credit. But, you know, the guy, he lies. And I don't think that you can achieve high political office in America today without being a truly accomplished, fully engorged nose.
Well, I think you know, in our political culture, the W.C. Fields element of it is that we've almost come to expect politicians to not be completely truthful with us.
Exactly.
What it boils down to.
Yeah, we want people who tell us what we want to hear, and that's what we've got.
I think that's one of the keys, and I think that until people value the truth more, and as you pointed out, a person who tells the truth does not have to worry about having a bad memory.
It sounds corny, as I said, but I mean, it really is true. I've been doing this talk show now going on 15 years, And that's the one thing that I based everything on, was just go on and tell everybody the absolute truth, that if that means somebody's going to drag me off the air, then so be it. But at least I'm not going to get hoisted up, you know, by my own petard here. And it hasn't happened. It's the truth. You just keep telling the truth. It works. It actually works.
Well, I think that one of the keys about, you know, the issue of truth is people's ability to have empathy or to feel it. And the reason for raising M. Scott Peck's name is that he wrote one of the better treaties in a book that was referred to as The People of the Lie. And it's the idea that, again, if you repeat the big lie often enough, it will almost become like a subliminal value to the point where people can't discern what constitutes their behavior. And he really wrote the book as sort of a wake-up call for people who work in places like Los Alamos or Livermore Labs, where basically devices are being designed on a daily basis to then in turn to be used, or its intended use, is nothing less than the entire mass murder of humanity is the only thing that these devices are good for. The bottom line being is that he gave an example of people who are so lacking in, say, psychic construct, the ability to feel or have empathy, that there was actually two parents who had taken a weapon that had been used by an elder son to commit suicide. And in order to show their son the family values of hunting and weaponry and things to this effect, they gave the younger son that same weapon for Christmas the following year.
Oh, my God.
And that upon interviewing this, these people saw absolutely nothing wrong in that. And when you look at this type of parenting, and then we wonder where incidences like Columbine come from, the roots of it, again, I believe, are in this issue of emotional intelligence, this lack of the exercise of the psychic dimensions of ourselves.
Well,
the word psychic, by the way, all it means in Greek root, it means of the mind and of the soul.
Well, Kevin, if we take present trends and there is not a reversal, in other words, if present trends continue in the linear upward curve they're in, where are we going? I know that's asking for some sort of conclusion, but I am asking an intuitive here. So where are we going?
Well, if the negative trends, as we speak about them, because we always exist in Schrodinger's box, which was his Schrodinger was said on a quantum level, two simultaneous realities can exist, and he demonstrated it by saying to put a cat in a box with a toxin that's released by, say, a radioactive substance, and you work out the math, that cat simultaneously will be both alive and dead from exposure to the toxin on a quantum level. And not until you open the box and look inside will you know which one has occurred. In other words, till you have made an observation. Now, if you continue to observe the negative trends, which are constantly reinforced by the media, I think that we're headed for some pretty dark scenarios, very much apocalyptic. When you consider the loss of life, when you're talking about the monarch butterfly is absolutely essential, one of the essential keys in the ecological chain.
Sure.
And it's been long said that sooner or later we may lose one of those key links in the ecology, and there could be entire regional collapses ecologically that could penetrate very much into the food chain. And basically, if the monarch butterfly was lost in the ecological chain, we would have an ecological disaster that, I mean, it would make the plagues of Egypt look like yesterday's news. If we continue, in my opinion, to create the equivalent of sort of this cesspool of weapons constantly available, and people are not, if you will, emotionally aligned with what the purpose of the tools in our society are for, per se. And weapons, for instance, have legitimate use in hunting. There is a legitimate culture that uses it as a tool. But if they're not emotionally aligned with it, we will have amplifications of what occurred in Columbine, to like where the school systems could end up looking like Lebanon did during the 60s.
Well, go back to the first real mass killer weapon, the atomic bomb. Manhattan Project. Yes, it was a thing that we had to do before someone else did it, to be sure. But You know, the scientists, when they pushed the first button, actually there was a considerable mainstream amount of opinion that said the entire atmosphere may go into a chain reaction and we may destroy ourselves when we push this button. There was mainstream thought.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, they pushed the button. Now, you know, the atmosphere didn't catch on fire, but a lot of experts thought that it might well occur, that we could destroy ourselves. And they nevertheless pushed that button. Science is doing this all the time. Mm-hmm. Science, for example, in San Francisco recently, some poor man dying of AIDS, they decided they would use some special radiation or something and destroy every last bit of what was his immune system, and then would put in a simian immune system, transfer literally from a simian to human being the immune system, I guess the spinal cord fluid. I'm not an expert, I don't know. But they said in the newspaper article there were certain risks for all of mankind that something that was simian could suddenly species jump as a result of this, and there could be potential problems. But they went ahead anyway. Now, I don't know about you, but nobody asked me. I've got a lot of empathy for anybody dying of AIDS, but I tell you, Kevin, when you have these things like, or the corn that's going to kill the monarchs, you know, they seem to go ahead with their own counsel and push these buttons, and one day they're going to push a button, they're going to go, oops.
I think that these things, you know, indeed are a matter of the historical record. The Tuskegee experiment, where an entire community based on a choice of race was allowed to have diagnosed cases of syphilis go untreated for a
just
period of
so we
years.
Could, so we could see what would happen.
And so we could see what the result was. And furthermore, see if it could be then traced to other parts. In other words, how it would be passed on as a contagion to other members of that community, how it would affect birth rates, et cetera, et cetera.
So ultimately then, Kevin, should we expect the morality of the general collective consciousness to grow beyond that which is its prime example, its government?
I have hope on that in the following way, Art. One, the collective types of consciousness we spoke of before, like the harmonic convergence.
Yes.
My encouragement is for us to not be afraid of our own human potential. For instance, while we're tracing, for instance, you know, letting gorge noses, simultaneously that implies that if an emotional response we can regulate involuntary actions in the body, such things as yoga, meditation, biofeedback,
yes.
All of these things provide extraordinary hopeful models for new medicine, for instance. And that if we were to begin to really reach into our potential as conscious entities, we can develop a whole new model upon which humanity would be able to base a counterpoint to these negative influences that seem to be, you know, continuously endorsed by governmental agencies.
Do you suppose it is possible that a smaller number of concentrated minds trying to produce a positive end result can overcome a sort of general apathetic negativity?
There seems to be research that supports that. In fact, I would go so far as to stick my neck out and say that I do endorse that concept. It's been referred to popularly as the Maharishi effect or the 100th monkey effect.
Right.
It's the idea that less than 1% of 1% of any representing population has the ability that if they hold a common positive value of any kind, that you will see an outbreak of that behavior on a positive level throughout the general representing community.
That makes sense. It really does make sense. It's just that I'm a little frightened of it, and I really don't know why. I don't know why. I'm trying to come to terms with that. These experiments I have tried that have worked, it's so tempting to apply the same concept to, for example, what's going on in Yugoslavia right
mm-hmm.
now,
mm-hmm.
Or some other, or perhaps our ecology.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a key governing factor built in your art, is that what it is that it's my belief that what we call the 100th monkey effect, per se, has a system of positives, checks and balances based on it. It's my belief that if the same thing can, say, be applied negatively, there seems to be studies that show, for instance, that brainwaves associated with negative thought have different what you call logarithms, and that they have, although they may act more quickly and by appearances more potently, their effects are more short-term.
Well, let me try the question straight out. Mm-hmm. Let me modify it a little bit. Is there as much power in the dark side as there is the light side?
I think that, I feel like Yoda at this particular moment.
Yeah.
Star Wars moment here. I think that what it is that there is yin and yang. Nothing in and of itself is inherently dark, that it's all tools. But I think that the overwhelming tendency of humanity is to seek out a common good.
Mm.
And to what we need to remember about the dark side is that the dark is just a shadow. But the shadow has, in other words, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. But the shadow has no substance, but it does have the function of, one, much like a sundial, it can let us know the time of day, and two, it also can point the way. In other words, let us know the direction that we are headed in, and that's what we need to look at in these trends.
I agree with all that, except, again, the straight-on question is, let's say Kevin Ryerson was a practitioner of the light, and Art Bell, to suit my audience, which probably believes it anyway, is a practitioner of the darkest of the dark. Well, would we have equal ability to affect outcomes?
Would we have equal ability?
To affect outcomes.
Intriguing thought. I would have to say that what it would boil down to is that each of us contain that same light and dark, and perhaps the dark practitioner... the thing that they don't realize is that they contain both elements. And so, therefore, they have tendencies to think that demonstrations of the practitioner of darkness is absolute evidence as to what constitutes their own superiority. But the person who practices light, their strength is that they know they often also contain that element we refer to as dark. Mother Teresa said, the reason that I pray is because there is the capacity of a Hitler inside of me. And she was constantly aware of that particular force inside of her, and that was her strength.
That's an amazing statement. Did she really say that?
Yes, she did. Yes, it's one of her most startling quotes. It's one of her most startling quotes.
There is the potential of Hitler within me?
She said that there is a potential of Hitler within me. There is a potential Hitler inside of me. That's why I pray for God's love.
It's remarkable. I never knew she said that.
Mm-hmm. Enlightened woman.
Very much so. That's an amazing quote. Wow. That's an amazing quote. And I think it's absolutely true as well. So, how do you see it going, generally? I know you're trying to be as positive as you can, but an honest assessment of trends right now, what would you say?
I would have to say an honest assessment of trends at this point in time is that the peculiar thing is, Art, is that, for instance, if everyone had the value of the being prepared, as you put it, just the old Boy Scout motto.
Sure.
When these disasters hit, you know, just like in these tremendous, you know, weather patterns, extremes that we've been experiencing, those communities, if they had that preparedness, just living in the path of that weather that they do on a daily basis, that community would have won, have been completely more autonomous from, dependency upon government, more self-sufficient, and been more available for their neighbors just by practicing those values of preparedness.
Well, all that is true. Hold on, Kevin. In the case of the people in the path of the F5, almost F6 in Oklahoma, I think, just about no preparedness can get you ready for that. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. It is magic. It's nighttime magic, and it's right here.
To reach Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. Or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
To Kevin Ryerson, who is one of our nation's great intuitives, and you may remember Kevin from Shirley MacLaine days. You know, Kevin, what is Shirley doing these days?
Well, actually, she's doing quite a bit. I was just with her on her birthday and a couple of days ago. She is just finishing up a film. It's about a young boy who, against all odds, and belief in angels. And in it, he goes through a great deal of what I think is very relevant to the issues that we're looking at in our schools now. He has like an inner emotional courage and a spiritual belief in the intervention of angels that leads him to, in his world, the equivalent of sort of like a personal triumph, per se. She's been working on that. It's now in post-production. She is looking for her next project at this very moment in time, and she is continuing on with exploring who Shirley is as a human being.
Good. As I think I mentioned to you the last time I had you on, it would really be fun to have her on one of these days. We share a lot of, I think, common beliefs.
I think so. You know, I mean, you hold a lot of common interests. She still holds, you know, very intense interests in the issues of extraterrestrial existence, you know, the meanings, the implications of that. And, you know, when she is conversing with people in a public forum, it's exactly on a lot of the subject materials that concern a lot of the listeners of this program.
Well, good. Let's zero in on that for a second. The extraterrestrial existence. What's your view? What's your sense? Your intuition about are we being visited, and if so, by whom?
To tell you the truth, I've had a number of personal episodes that I choose to interpret as extraterrestrial contact. I think that they've been here for quite some period of time. I have a tendency to believe in the esoteric history that Casey subscribes to, the belief in Atlantis. And I think there was a time, Art, when in Atlantis we had a civilization that was on par with those that we refer to as extraterrestrials. And that we had many of the abilities that we attribute to the phenomena that a lot of your listeners, you know, call in and tell us about.
Mm-hmm.
And as a person who works with intuition, and I see intuition, clairvoyance, telepathy, or, you know, even the terms remote viewing, which are scientific terms for those same phenomena, I see these things as methodologies or technologies. And with all due respect to the phone company, I would assume that the ETs, when it comes to communications, has something far more advanced then is not beyond our comprehension, but what is currently in use as the general organizing principles in our own society. I have a tendency to believe that a lot of these phenomena are better explained by a parapsychological model than some of even the models we're attempting, you know, to address these things as like, oh, you know, electromagnetic drive, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. Define that more closely, if you're able. Parapsychological, in other words, the monster from our id, or a valid...
Classic movie, Forbidden Planet.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So would you look at that, or would you look at a real external parapsychological phenomena ongoing?
Well, I would look at it as though the same way that I suggested that yoga, for instance, could be a very advanced model for medicine. I would suggest that since we are using biofeedback, for instance, to train, you know, astronauts and people who work in space, that's an example of where parapsychology is being applied in our own extraterrestrial program, let's call it that. We know that there have been a number of very successful telepathic experiments done, and people such as Edgar Mitchell, who walked on the moon, is the founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. So it's not that we're completely devoid of beginning to work, you know, with some of this paranormal phenomena within the context, for instance, say, of our own space program and various other areas of our sciences. But one of the things I would suggest is that phenomena such as Uri Geller, if you accept the studies that were done on him, and I do, when he would bend spoons, these spoons would not only you know, just be twisted into these funny forms. When they studied the metals seemed to take on very unusual properties. They seemed to have a higher degree of conductivity. There were certain steels that were bent that they almost appeared to become like a whole new alloy that had entirely different properties than before the metal had been bent. Some of the metals that were theoretically recovered from UFO sites seem to display some of these unusual parapsychological signatures, if you will.
Have you seen the mind actually bend a spoon to your own satisfaction? Have you seen the mind do something external, physically affect something to your own satisfaction?
I have seen mind, in my opinion, on the part of very gifted people, to be able to indeed bend metal, et cetera, et cetera. I've even had experiences myself where I felt the collective consciousness was able to affect weather cycles. One of those was a trip that we took to Egypt. There was about 20 folks. They were all fairly gifted people, too. They were all artists, et cetera, et cetera. And we came to the conclusion a week before getting 3 hours of private time inside the Great Pyramid that we might like to see if some of the attributes of the Great Pyramid being used for climate control was feasible. And finally, after a week, when we got to the Great Pyramid, the government arranged that we could have private time inside of it. And we went inside, we meditated. There had been a drought that had been occurring in Egypt at that time. And 3 hours later, when we came out from having entered with totally clear skies, one of the largest storms that had been experienced in that vicinity of the globe was hovering directly over Cairo. And the precise hub of that particular storm, which was considered extremely unusual for that time of the year, was anchored right over the Great Pyramid. The second day, we went inside the second pyramid, and we did meditations that you might call release meditations. And within an hour of those meditations, the storm dissipated. So I really believe in this phenomena that there is an intricate link between consciousness and general physics or phenomenology.
I couldn't agree more. I have made the same determination myself. I have this nervous little tick, though, when I endeavor to do something, kind of like the scientist who's modifying the corn genetics a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for example, as I think we talked about this, but weather, for example,
mm-hmm.
to modify the weather, well, I believe it can be done with mass concentration.
Mm-hmm.
But what if you made a mistake? What if there was a hurricane lurking headed toward the East Coast or Florida, the Keys, whatever, and you did a mass concentration and you stalled the damn thing,
mm-hmm.
and it built up to a category 4 or 5 and then slammed into land?
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that I'm worried about.
Yeah, well, believe me, the capacity for human comedy and human drama has to be a factor in these things. When we were talking about the F5 or whatever tornado, one of the points of the matter is those people are now building houses, for instance, where traditionally in the suburbs, where the urban core never used to be, they're building houses there where there are known scars of past earthquake, I'm sorry, past tornado paths have traveled there before.
Absolutely true.
And one of the things is, for instance, one of the cities that has one of the worst pollutions is Denver. Well, when they were first building Denver, Native Americans said, you know, you shouldn't build there because when the buffalo go there, they stir up a lot of dust and the dust never goes anywhere. So it's not a good place to live. So when you have people who, if you will, are psychically sensitive, you know, to issues of the ecology, when they really have that covenant with the earth, you know, that the Bible talks about.
Sure.
These types of practices of collective consciousness, I think almost are just second nature. You know?
Well, they actually have cleaned up Denver, by the way, a little bit.
Yes, they have.
It used to be awful, but it's quite a bit better at the moment.
They have. And those, to me, those kinds of efforts, you know, that are acknowledged there, for instance, are where people are becoming psychically or emotionally sensitive, you know, to what's occurring around them. You know, we don't have to wait until these huge calamities that occur.
However, let me add this. The tornado in Oklahoma City.
Yes.
The F5.
The finger of God, as they refer to it.
Yeah. They clocked that officially at 318 miles per hour. Now, there is something called the Fujita scale, which actually goes to 12.
Mm.
But according to science, an F6, which would be 319 miles per hour, is impossible in our atmosphere. Actually impossible. And there are reports that though the official clock was at 318, they believe it was 324. So the impossible occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there have been a succession of them since, these what they call super cells,
mm-hmm.
super storms, if
mm-hmm.
you will. Something is definitely changing with our weather. I won't stick my neck out and say it's a profound forever change and that we're doomed. It may be cyclical, it may be short, or it may be the beginning of a, from our point of view, long-term change. I don't know, but I've stopped wondering about whether it's changing. It is.
That's absolute. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The El Nino effects that were in California, the traditional drought cycles that we're able to trace through the, you know, through measuring the, what you call the climate, you know, stratas, for instance, here's, for instance, throughout the Southwest, there have never been weather cycles that we have known in the area of the complexity and the recurrence of the phenomenology. So something definitely is afoot here.
Well, do you think that it is a reaction? Again, we may have talked of this last time around, I'm not sure, but a caller called me and said, hey, Art, Mother Earth is mad at us, angry at us. And I said, no. Mother Earth doesn't get mad, she gets even. And by that I meant that if there is an imbalance, the Earth simply does what the Earth does and through whatever means corrects that imbalance.
I think that the term self-correction is an important thing to understand. You know, one of the things as human beings is that I think it's time for us to become God's adults. It's one thing to be children of God. I think it's, however, time to become God's adults because, quite frankly, I think that we have a tendency to develop what I call an addiction to miracles.
Mm-hmm.
That we associate the miraculous, so the intervention and the suspension of natural laws in order to save humanity as part of the way that God loves us. And I think that's a perfectly fine model, romantically speaking. But simultaneously, it's my belief that humanity, with this issue of emotional intelligence, and here's the other thing, quite frankly, if we do have these impacts on these weather cycles consciously, who's to say these things also are not occurring unconsciously? And the bottom line being that we need to break this addiction to miracles because it's my belief that humanity has developed what I refer to as a crisis-based identity, that perhaps we are the very source of these extraordinary negative phenomena.
But again, are we not being led by our engorged noses by our own, very own government? In other words, our government definitely governs by a sort of a crisis mentality. They deal with things as they have to. As they're putting out fires constantly, whatever it is, whether it's children killing children, guns for them or against them, how you feel about guns, they do not jump up by themselves and mow people down. It takes a person to pick it up.
I would agree with that. In particular, I go back to my original thesis as to the issue of emotional intelligence. That if our entire model is I think, therefore I am, in other words, our entire existence is based on that model of logic, which completely discounts the value of the ability to feel and to know that the emotions of other people are equally valid. The higher you get into what you might consider to be the elite, the educational, academic elite of our culture, mm-hmm. the more you have to adapt to that model of thinking. And then, in turn, if we abandon our ability to acknowledge our own ability to think and come up with our own solutions, and we turn towards those elite institutions for problem-solving models that are devoid of the very essence to develop a value system that works, you know, on a fully intricate and human scale, we are only further intensifying this addiction to looking towards solutions that are guaranteed to be dysfunctional.
You remember Where Have You Gone, Joe DiMaggio?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what we have today. I mean, everything's gone. Every institution, everything we once believed in has turned out to have an Achilles heel. All our heroes seem to be gone. All our examples seem to be gone. And we seem to be wandering aimlessly.
Well, I think that that's one of the things that Joseph Campbell talked about, is the idea that we need to build a new inner mythic archetype, that we need, that this is an opportunity to discover new archetypal energies for ourselves, that our emotions are energies, and the word dharma means the energy that does the work, and that we need to rediscover that core energy that does the work, and then these extraordinary changes occurring in climates, government, you know, every planetary institution will be able to, if you will, self-correct, maybe come online, and then a new potential can open up for humanity.
All right, Kevin, hold it right there, and we'll be right back.
It's been a too long time with no peace of mind. And I'm ready for the times to get better.
Me too. We're going to open up the lines for Kevin Ryerson shortly, so if you have questions, come ahead. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Change, it is a coming.
I've got to tell you, I've been racking my brain, hoping to find a way. I've had enough of this continual rain. Changes are coming, no doubt.
There's a port on a western bay, and it serves 100 ships a day. Lonely sailors pass the time away and talk about their homes. And there's a girl in this harbor town, and she works laying whiskey down. They say brandy, fetch another round. She serves them whiskey and wine. The sailors say brandy, you're a fine girl.
In the Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
Well, the latest headlines are, NATO considers halt to bombing, bombs hit hospital and envoys' homes. Pretty smart, huh? Collateral damage. Isn't that what they call it? Collateral damage? Bombs for peace. I'm never going to get over that, nor will I ever agree with what we're doing. Kevin Ryerson is my guest, and if you have questions for him, we're about to go to the phones, and your questions literally can range anywhere you want them to go. He's a pretty diverse fella. One of our nation's great intuitives. I'm Art Bell, and this, of course, is Coast to Coast AM. Ryerson, a quick switch of topics here, Kevin, then we'll go to the phone.
Okay.
I've got a BBC News article here indicating that a U.S. billionaire is going to put cameras and airborne equipment over the U.K. this coming crop circle season, and he is going to find out once and for all whether it's guys with boards and chains and people or whether it's some sort of natural or unnatural phenomena. What do you think they will end up finding?
Well, I've done meditations in the middle of some of those crop circles, and it's my belief that it's a combination of an extraterrestrial phenomena and what I would refer to as a natural chi phenomena. The crop circles have been appearing for years, but historically they began to intensify after, interestingly enough, the harmonic convergence.
That's true.
And have you ever seen, you know, frost on a cold window? And the static electricity forms the pattern. I have a tendency to note the pattern of the crop circles form around sites like, say, Stonehenge, for instance. And it's my belief that when there is increased extraterrestrial activities, there's these extra sightings that occur, there's almost energy that is released from almost what you might consider acupuncture points on the planet. And then as that goes out into the wheat field, it forms these highly complicated geometrical patterns. Now, I also believe that there's some extraterrestrial phenomena because when they start putting some of these patterns together, they make very interesting either chemical compositions or patterns upon which certain elements are based, et cetera, et cetera. So there could actually be a language that is emerging as we collect the crop circles, and there could be a message in it. You know, whether it's just a cosmic sort of eat at Joe's, who knows? But I think the phenomena is a way of focusing our consciousness once again, you know, on the idea of a consciousness that is just greater than what our society has produced at this point in time, and that it raises consciousness to look into these kinds of issues.
So in other words, you lean toward there really is something to it.
Yes, I look towards it as that there is an energetic phenomenon. I really respect the fact that England's produced some really nice sort of like, you know, 70-year-old guys who are pretty athletic, and they have an interesting theory because they are landscape engineers, but there is no way that they singularly can explain the whole phenomenon.
Absolutely not. Not over 10 acres, not done in the space of 20 minutes according to pilot's testimony and all the rest of that. These intricate 190 circle arrays that are just unbelievable, very intricate, it just couldn't be done by man.
No, the complexity of the patterns are extraordinary, and there's just things that when you get on the site, you can almost instantaneously separate those created, you know, using landscape engineering techniques and those that are the genuine phenomena.
When I had the opportunity to lay in the sarcophagus in the Great Pyramid, I had a feeling that can't be described, and I wonder if it's similar to that which you feel inside of a legit crop circle.
You know, it's very similar. I've been in the sarcophagus on several occasions. It's almost like there's like a static electricity running through you.
I
think the yogis would call it kundalini energy. And it's very similar to that phenomenon.
Whatever it was, it was funny because, as you know, having climbed that Great Pyramid yourself inside, by the time, did you go in warm weather?
I've been there in the summertime.
Then you know what that climb is like in the summertime.
It's extraordinary.
Oh, my God. And I got to that, if you're going to have a heart attack, that would be it.
Mm.
When I got to the top, I was kind of chuckling about the prospect of getting into the sarcophagus, you know, kind of, I think I'll jump in there and take a photo. And I got in there, and they took a couple of photos, all right, but what happened wiped the smile from my face, and I can't adequately explain it. All right, look, a lot of people want to talk to you, so let's try that.
Okay.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Good evening, Mr. Ryerson, Art Bell.
Yes, sir.
My name is David. I'm calling from Riverbank, California.
Okay.
Earlier in the show, Art, you asked a question as to whether a practitioner of the darkness could be as effectual in bringing about change in the objective realm as a practitioner who's practicing in the light.
I did, yes.
And I'm wondering if you can possibly imagine yourself standing in a pitch-dark room with a door leading into a room that's very well illuminated.
Yes.
If you looked under the crack of the door, would you see the light from the light room penetrating into the darkness?
Well,
interesting metaphor.
Yeah.
If you were to go over into the other room and again close the door and look down under the crack of the door, would you see the darkness penetrating into the light?
You might see a shadow.
No, not like you would if you were in the dark. The light would penetrate into the dark.
Well,
you
listen.
You always follow the light to a source.
It is.
You can never follow darkness to a source.
Yes, it is an interesting metaphor. I'm not sure, though, that it's an ultimate truth. Kevin?
I think it's an interesting metaphor. I actually lean towards, I think, the gentleman's insight, because, like I said, I believe that practitioners of the dark consider themselves an absolute, whereas the very strength of the practitioners of light is that they know that they might be capable of, you know, of that same darkness. So they actually have the advantage of both sides of the yin-yang pattern.
All right.
Thank you.
Let me say this. A caller?
Yes.
Before you go? I hope you're both right. How's that, all right?
Excellent. Big enough world for that.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Art?
Fine, sir. Where are you?
Aragon, Georgia.
In Georgia, okay.
Yeah, I was just had a comment for Kevin to say that, you know, the late Jerry Garcia, comment from him, he quoted, you can't really change the world. You can only really make a corner for yourself. But
that may be somewhat.
I think it's very interesting, all the stuff you guys are talking about.
That may be a somewhat macroscopic view, though.
It's an interesting view. If you look at Jerry Garcia as prophet per se, maybe if we took each little corner of the world, that we're all out to change per se. Maybe it's all one big, you know, patchwork quilt. And maybe we're all just part, you know, if you've ever gone across the United States, you know, by air, and you look down particularly over my native Midwest in Ohio, you see all these different farms down there. But also you'll notice there's all these different rivers, streams, and topography, in other words, an ecology that they're all interdependent upon.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I guess if you think of Jerry Garcia as a, you know, as a prophet, maybe he has his own form of immortality and is still out there doing good by Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia, which is one of my favorites. Brings a lot of joy to life.
Very possible.
All right, caller. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, okay. I'm on the air.
Yeah, you would appear to be. Where are you?
I'm Paul from Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
I have an opinion and a question.
All right.
My opinion on the circles formed in the fields.
Yes, sir.
I do believe that a lot of these patterns are created from, let's say, extraterrestrials in deep space, using some sort of concentrated beam or something to give us messages that we're supposed to interpret.
All right, that's a cool opinion. Let me give you one for you to contemplate. All right.
Okay.
I would suggest to you that maybe these are messages from beneath the earth itself.
I was going to say that.
Were you now?
That was going to be my second part of that.
I see. All right. Well, you have a question?
And my question is to Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, do you believe that we are all entities that are in this, let's say, material realm, and we've been here a long time?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see, you're from Columbus, Ohio, right?
Yeah.
So you're a fellow Buckeye.
Yes, I
hail from Sandusky, Ohio, originally.
Okay, go Buckeye.
Yeah. Basically, my belief is that we are spiritual beings who are here to experience being physical rather than that we are physical beings trying to become spiritual.
I agree.
Yeah, I subscribe to the idea that, you know, there was one collective consciousness, we'd call it the deity.
Mm-hmm.
There were creative acts on the part of that deity.
Mm-hmm.
But over a span, as the Hindus believe, over billions of years, it's called Brahma wakes and Brahma sleeps.
And that is the expansion and contraction of the universe. But I believe that as souls, we are co-creators with that original collective consciousness, and that we're here to diversify the creation, and that when we are working with light, we're cooperating with the ecology, and new life is emerging.
Mm-hmm.
When we are not practicing that, or we are fundamentally unconscious of our nature, then we end up with some of the results like we've been discussing on this show, you know, the type of crisis that's occurring in the ecology and the crisis that's occurring in our human community.
They are not disconnected.
Absolutely. I've always agreed. I mean, I agree with you 100%, Kevin. I believe that we are spiritual, and we came into the flesh either to learn or to experience this life or this life form.
Okay, well, we're all toying around a little bit with the concept of reincarnation. Do you embrace that, Kevin?
Yes, I do. I believe in reincarnation as a creative vehicle through which we are able to re-experience events that we had set in motion in other lifetimes.
And that then explains the sometimes inexplicable. People will say, how could a compassionate God do that?
I think it's a good way to look at it, that it's much more reasonable to assume that what it is that the separation from the deity that it speaks in the Bible is of and in itself enough of a punitive phenomena that we don't need to pile on top of it imaginary dimensions of, you know, eternal punishment, et cetera, et cetera. And that it's reclaiming that connection on the level of the soul that is really what our purpose here in the earth plane is.
Are we supposed to fear God?
Well, you know, the word fear in its root word actually means awe. It means one should be in awe of the deity. And as Einstein said, basically, the most important emotion we can feel is a sense of awe or a sense of wonder.
Oh, well, if that would be the definition, then yes, indeed.
Yes, it's what I refer to as one of the God emotions. Jealousy, it says God is a jealous God, and simply jealousy means identifying what already belongs to you.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Top of the morning to you.
Hey, top of the morning to you.
Yes, sir.
Hi, how you doing, Art?
We're fine.
You know what? I almost got kicked out of Sunday school like you, but you know what I did?
What?
I got baptized.
And that changed everything.
Well, yeah. You got to fit in with the crowd, don't you?
Well, if it worked that way for you, sir, I'm happy for you. In my case, and I was baptized, by the way.
Are you Catholic?
Lutheran.
Really?
Yeah, really.
God love him.
But I asked too many questions that there weren't ready answers for, and I guess I was disturbing the class, and so I was out.
You want to believe. You're a skeptic, but you want to believe, don't you?
Yes.
All right. I have a question for Kevin.
Yes.
Yeah? Now, Kevin, have you ever heard of a guy named Tim LaHaye?
Tim LaHaye? Boy, you might have me there. I'm not certain.
When I was going to church, there's this guy named Tim LaHaye, and he came up with something called the four temperament types.
Mm-hmm.
In the church, the conservative church, it stretches back to Jung with the melancholy type.
Jung's model, I know. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, the four types have to do with Gilligan's Island. What's that?
Whether you're the captain or Gilligan or Mr. Howell or something.
Well, it's the body, soul, mind, and spirit. It's red and yellow, black and white.
Yeah.
And for some reason, for the universe that we're caught up in, first there's the one, then there's the two, the male and female, and then it breaks off into the four types, which is has to do with the four elements of the zodiac. Can you speak on that?
Well, astrology is a whole, thing in itself. I mean, biblically speaking, there was the suggestion that the 12 apostles, for instance, were each a zodiacal type. The entity John, being associated, for instance, with the constellation Leo, which is why he was always
in
leadership.
Wait a minute, where did you get that
position.
One from?
But as to the elements, I mean, you have air, water, fire, and earth.
in the book of Revelations, it talks about the four beasts that surround the throne of God, or the four, gates that, the four directions, you know, that the three gates face, and that's all associated with astrology. But each is an archetype. You know, earth people bond with the earth. Water people are emotional or psychic. Air folks are more intellectual. And basically your fire types, which I'm a Leo, like to assume so-called leadership positions.
What a cosmic joke it would be if everything was nothing more than analogous to Gilligan's Island.
You know, Jung talks about that we're competing for new archetypes. You know, I'm rooting for Star Wars, but if Gilligan's Island is an equal competition, you know, every myth needs a court jester.
that's exactly right. All right, you're good on time. You sound like you're very awake. Are you? Are you?
Yeah, fine.
Good. Then hold on. We'll be right back. I'm going to take a little extra time and do something I always love to do whenever the topic of reincarnation comes around, because not many people have heard this, but you hear it here. Listen very, very carefully to the words.
I was a highwayman. Along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. The masters hung me in the spring of 25, but I am still alive. I was a sailor, I was born upon the tide. I did abide. I sailed a schooner around the Horn of Mexico. I went aloft to furl the mainsail in a blow. And when the yards broke off, they said that I got killed. But I'm living still. I was a dam builder across a river deep and wide, where steel and water did collide. A place called Boulder on the Wild Colorado. I slipped and fell into the wet concrete below. They buried me in that great tomb that knows no sound, but I'm still around. I'll always be around, 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 around. I fly a starship across the universe divide, and when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again. Or I may simply be a single drop of rain. But I will remain. I'll be back again and again and again and again and again.
This is Coast to Coast AM.
Listen to the wind blow, watch the sun.
Kingdom of Nye on the Wildcard Line at 1-775-727-1295. That's 1-775-727-1295. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
Never supposed to break that chain. Good morning, everybody. Kevin Ryerson is here, one of the great intuitives on this planet. If you want to talk to him, he's as close as your phone. Here to be confirmation of what I said earlier. Y2 chaos on CBS TV this weekend, despite the billions being spent to deal with Y2K computer bug. Many cities in America are uncertain they'll be able to continue to provide basic services like water and electricity. On January 1st, 2000, reports 60 Minutes in a new shock story being readied for this Sunday. CBS's Steve Croft is putting the finishing touches on his controversial report. This is coming from Matt Drudge. Mary Ellen Hanley, a computer systems specialist hired by the District of Columbia, tells wide-eyed Croft that she believes Washington will continue to function January 1, 2000, but it must be prepared for what many cities could face. That's from Matt Drudge. Kevin?
Yes?
Interesting. What's your take? What's your intuitive take on Y2K?
I think it's something that's been ignored for too long. I'm actually working with some people who are working on solutions for Y2K. And the way our cities have been built and structured is that they are vulnerable to the over-computerization of our society in the fundamental services as just being described. Anyone, for instance, who lived, and I did, in a suburb in Phoenix for 10 years knows that when there was just the slightest interference in the basic service of water, per se, you are like literally in the middle of nowhere. Is what it boils down to. So, I think that there are solutions to Y2K. I've actually worked on it with some of the folks. But two, I wonder whether or not we have the will to institute them, is what it boils down to. And given some of the penchant of our government to sort of like experiment with people's lives, that's an authentic concern too.
It sure is. Well, did you ever see a movie called Trigger Effect?
The Trigger Effect. I'm not certain I have. But
I've been running on the movie services, and basically it was a several-day power outage caused by, well, they never really explained, but it didn't matter. It observed the social breakdown that occurred. You know, for a few hours, everybody was okay. Even a day, everybody was okay, neighbors helping out, and so forth and so on. But when people began to perceive that it was going to continue for a protracted period, things really began to fall apart fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess one might conclude that our civilization or our civilized nature hangs by a very thin thread indeed, or maybe it's a lot thicker than I think it is. I don't know.
Well, one of the things is when people say something's hanging by a hair, for instance, you have to understand that hair has come to be known to have a higher actual tensile strength under stress than carbon steel. But so maybe there's something in that metaphor for us. You know, again, Art, I go back to our conversation in the original hour about that in these different scenarios we examine, it is the breakdown of the emotional and psychic bonds between people that always lead, you know,
yes, sir,
to these crises that we see in these films, for instance. So if we can rediscover that thread, you know, of continuity, of that psychic bond that makes humanity, you know, one living organism, you know, intricately linked to Gaia, the Earth itself as a living organism, then perhaps these crises can be averted.
Maybe a good analogy would be Shirley MacLaine's very thin cord that nevertheless, as thin as it got, out to the moon or beyond, brought her back.
Right. Right. It's the astral cord, the astral connection that exists between each and every one of us. You might think of it as like some psychic umbilical cord that links us to the goddess.
I'll try that. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Where are you, please?
Well, I'm in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, Tornado Alley.
How's weather out there?
Well, I don't need to have my lights on. The lightning is continuous.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Again tonight?
Well, tonight it was calm for the past few days, but they're issuing weather alerts.
And here we go again, huh?
Mm. Yeah, well, it doesn't look nearly as bad.
Good.
Bartlesville, isn't that where the Frank Lloyd Wright building is?
Are you speaking of Price Tower?
Yes.
Yes.
How did it hold up?
The tree in the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's Frank Lloyd Wright's study in triangles.
Mm-hmm.
As well as the community center, which is circular and really belongs out in Marin County.
Interesting. Yeah, yes. Marin has a circular building. Used to live right next to it, city center.
The courtrooms there are circular, which is the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Well, he designed it a little bit after the Knights of the Round Table, so everyone's equal. That doesn't set up higher than you do.
Well, Kevin, as a fellow intuitive, I have a couple of questions here.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the Earth School concept, which I heard you allude to,
mm-hmm.
And in combination with astrology, which of the 12 signs might be the exit sign, the most difficult sign to learn the lessons of, and the sign in which you would complete your education?
Mm-hmm. Well, the traditional zodiac goes from Aries, the original primal fire, to Pisces. And we were just in the age of Pisces, and that's the issue of belief. And I guess if you're dealing with anything we'll deal with in our lifetime, we only have two more clicks, or 75 degrees of that age, before we enter into the age of Aquarius, which is the age of knowing. And each sign has its own exit, if you will, or its own complement in what you have to learn from the opposing sign. So rather than laying out the whole zodiac, you know, as a pathway that's circular, you have to look at the complementary opposites. For instance, I'm a Leo, and theoretically Aquarius would be my exit sign, that I have to master my ideals, otherwise my passions, you know, might somehow overrun me, per se.
Uh-huh. So as a 29th degree Scorpio with Taurus on the horizon at birth, you know, I've sort of have a little bit of an edge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Your north node is supposed to be part of your exit strategy, too.
Well, we'll take another look at that.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Speaking of exit strategies, I wish we had one from Yugoslavia right now.
Yes, that would be nice.
You know, they made all this noise about how the U.S. will no longer enter conflicts as part of the U.N. or anything else without an entrance strategy and an exit strategy. In other words, you're going to go in, you're going to do something, you're going to get out. Well, we're not getting out.
Yeah. It's interesting, Art, because in a way we almost entered this century's first series of conflicts because of issues in Yugoslavia that laid down the foundations for World War I.
And two.
And then in turn laid down the foundations for World War II. So maybe we have to, remember when we said in the event horizon, the only way out is in?
Yes.
Maybe if we can find some kind of solution that we entered this civilization with, rather than burying it for a change, maybe that's part of the exit strategy out of this century into the millennium.
That may well be. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Hi.
Yeah, hi. My name is Bill, and I'm calling from Burbank, California.
Hi, Bill.
Before I have a question for your guest that I'm sure he could answer, or at least help me finding my answer, I'd like to make something available for your consideration, Art. Among other things, including an interest in electronics, I also, like you have alluded to many times on your show that I've heard, I have no problem with conceptualizing a creator of all of this phenomena that I find myself and everyone else in, but it's God's always been a tough thing just for me to nail down. And then I started trying to analyze, well, what does a creator really mean and what could it be? And I thought, wait a minute, if a creator does a good enough job, that precludes the necessity for a God to, like, intervene, maintain, sustain, or whatever. Now, I knew from my comparative studies of various religions that the Eastern, the Hindus especially, they have their trinity consisting of the God that creates, the God that sustains, and the God that destroys, and they have the cycle that goes on and on and on. And that makes kind of sense to me, but a good creator would build a machine that doesn't need repairs, doesn't need anybody to ride the levels or you know, do anything or be there to respond to our needs. And that's why I've become very comfortable and been able to come back to Christianity, avoiding Christianity and being more concerned with learning about Jesus and what was so good about him. But that's just the one thing I wanted you to maybe consider, that, you know, a creator is all we needed, and the rest is up to us, kind of. And as far as your experiment with mass mind control,
yes,
don't worry that your well-intended actions are going to create any lasting or serious harm, because I think that from my 40 years of observation from various positions, most of the things that I've considered good have always turned out to have effects, repercussions, and ramifications that somehow or another didn't make them look so bright and shiny and perfectly good after a little bit of 20/20 hindsight and a little bit more information. But even to the extent that, like, this one really jerks emotions, I mean, Hitler is pretty well commonly thought of as the epitome of evil, you know, the personification of evil, and pretty much everybody can kind of agree with that. But the facts are, he probably, with the exception of the 6 million or more that he, you know, caused grievous bodily harm, if not death and torture to, he probably has really been more instrumental than any single person in affecting the Zionist realization of their state of Israel only 3 years after his demise. And, you know, you could say that's good, but then now you could say that the existence of Israel may be the beginning of World War III. So the problem is not with what's good and what's evil. The problem is us making those arbitrary determinations, I think. Because everything that's ever happened to me that I've hated the worst has been somebody doing something that they thought was best for me. And that's just the thing I would offer there. And if you want to try something instead of weather control, because you don't want people to have car accidents and feel responsible or whatever, have your group, your audience, consider going out under the night sky and making some stars spin around, and let's mess with some whole civilizations, possibly.
Well, Kevin?
Well, I think for a Christian gentleman, you sound remarkably Buddhist, and I admire
that. I'm not a Christian. I'm a student of Jesus and a practitioner of Buddhist
Excellent.
Practices.
Okay. Well, for someone who's studying Christ-oriented teachings, then. You know, it's intriguing. You know, the issue of the creator deity or the non-creator deity, Stephen Hawking talks about, for instance, that the universe is self-creating, and there's absolutely no need for God to really to do anything, is what it boils down to. However, I don't think we can eliminate the mystery or, quite frankly, the reality of our own consciousness and the way the consciousness interfaces with collective effects in nature, for instance. Now, it's my belief from, you know, similar studies in Buddhism, et cetera, that we can reclaim, you know, our Buddha nature. In Zen, they present you with a koan where they say, if you do something, you lose your Buddha nature, and if you do nothing, you lose your Buddha nature. And the term mind control, for instance, to some of the suggestions about collective acts of consciousness, I would not use exactly that term myself. I would say that if we form collective consensus that arises out of what we might refer to as our inner Christ or our inner Buddha nature, and then trying to reflect on that, we will find that we have a natural harmonic or a natural harmony with the forces around us. But then we still then observe those particular results. St. Paul himself said, have no concern because all things conspire to a common good.
Very good. First time caller line, you are on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Hi.
Hey, Art. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Your show really defies mediocrity, Art.
I hope so. We make a nightly attempt. Sometimes we do, sometimes not.
I've been trying to work day shift for the last couple of months, and it's been really hard.
Sorry.
Listening to your show. Good morning, Kevin.
Hello.
I heard somebody say once the universe created us so it can become aware of itself.
You know, I like that. It's called the anthropomorphic concept of the universe. It's one of those principles in science where it says that if you can't observe it or haven't observed it, it doesn't exist. And that's one of those paradoxes that Schrodinger and the Heidelberg uncertainty principle are based on, per se. So it's the idea that the universe developed the process of evolution so scientists could come in existence to see it so it could exist.
Huh.
Are you familiar with the works of Carlos Castaneda?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What validity do you give to his works?
Well, you know, Don Juan's concept of the predatory universe, I think, is going a little overboard in the idea that death is what the universe is all about. He would have to, in my opinion, push past it and see himself reborn in another universe, because the universe dies and recreates itself, as the gentleman was implying before, because it says Brahma wakes and Brahma sleeps. So there's just infinite potential available to each and every one of us. I do like his models of dreaming. I think that probably Castaneda's most comprehensive book was The Art of Dreaming. And the idea that, you know, that there are non-organic beings, et cetera, et cetera. I have certainly encountered some of those psychic states in my own adventures, per se. But I don't agree with the conclusion that the universe is a predatory universe. I think it's a place of infinite potential.
Yeah, there's differing views among the different seers that are in the party. If you've read all the books, there's a lot of duality. Different spheres.
Yeah, I think his two most comprehensive books are his first work, The Teachings of Don Juan. The Eagle's Gift has a lot of clarity, and The Art of Dreaming.
Danny and Brinkley spoke of having a panoramic life review several times during his near-death experiences. In several of the Castaneda's books, he talks about doing exactly that while we're still alive, and he calls it the recapitulation. Trying to do a panoramic life review, and by doing so, regaining our power and our energy. And by doing that, that will help us become seers and see the real world as it really is, and ourselves as we really are.
Right. The whole concept behind Zen Buddhism is that, you know, one of the powerful points to contemplate are the events of one's life, and as they come into context, it's like there's a self-forgiveness that occurs. So you're no longer dominated by emotions like guilt or, gee, could I have done something different, et cetera, et cetera. And just in fundamental psychology, you're reclaiming, you know, a basic sense of yourself that empowers you to then move on to other more extraordinary creations in life.
We also may be forced to make judgments upon ourselves, ultimately. Wouldn't you think?
Judgments.
Judgments, yeah. In other words, if you have a panoramic life review, actually, we don't have enough time to do this before the break. We'll do it right after the break, so stay right there, Kevin. Kevin Ryerson is my guest. This is Coast to Coast AM.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me. And I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can't see.
Darkness, my old friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath a halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence.
To reach Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0900. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
Who said I do not know? Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you.
You know, it's really interesting. Interviewed, Simon and Garfunkel said these words really had no meaning. It's like an impressionistic painting. But they do have meaning, don't they?
And the people bow and pray to the neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the word that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, tenement halls.
They really do have meaning, don't they?
The sounds of silence.
Or is that just all of us wrapping our minds around those words? Back to Kevin Ryerson, as promised. How are you doing out there, Kevin? You still with us?
Good, good. I think I'm a member of the original Cafe Society. You know, where we sit around discussing things all night long.
Are you kind of a night person?
I can be. I like getting up both early in the morning and staying up pretty late at night. Edgar Cayce said that the most psychic hours are between midnight and up into sunrise.
Oh, I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it. And all my life, whether I'm working or not, particularly when I'm not, I always drift towards staying awake in the nighttime hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless tied to a 9-to-5 daytime job, and it's been a lot of years since I've done that. So I just naturally drift to those hours for some reason. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Art Bell and Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Kevin. This
Hello.
Is Marcia in Fort Smith, Arkansas, listening to you on KWHN 1320 AM.
You betcha.
Mr. Ryerson, this is one of the greatest honors of my life, getting to speak to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
I didn't run across Out on a Limb until just over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And for a year and a half prior to that time, I had been experiencing quite a bit of what Shirley went through.
Mm-hmm.
Without the travel and without the study, everything I've learned has hit me between the eyes like a two before.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking earlier about reincarnation.
Yes.
And about the fact that we are spiritual beings coming into the physical form to experience things which we had previously set in motion.
Uh-huh.
Okay, at least one school of reincarnationism teaches that we choose the life we're going to live.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is going to be a very unpopular view of what went on in Littleton, Colorado a month ago.
Uh-huh.
If we choose the life we are to live, did not each one of those people who died then choose that end?
Well, the theory of reincarnation in general says that people have a choice in their lives, which also meant the perpetrators of the incident, you know, had choices that they could have made also. In other words, they could have exercised free will and come into some type of consciousness. The classic thing is that illness happens in the world when good people take no action. Also, I'd like to point out there were a number of heroic individuals. The young woman who, when literally staring death in the face, you know, chose to express her belief in the deity, in God.
Yes.
So therefore, heroic choices are available to us also, and I think that's one of the things we can focus on when we subscribe to these kinds of belief in reincarnation.
Okay, well, I've been bothered by that one for the last month. Torn between, well, you know, this is what they chose. There is a reason for this.
Mm-hmm.
And then seeing the turmoil that has been kept going.
Mm-hmm. I think the key to it is that just because choices were made, per se, it doesn't mean that it to be dissociative, you know, from your compassion, your feelings. And the idea that there are other alternatives is what it boils down to, because choices are being made all the time.
That's right.
I think one of the important choices is that the Kabbalah says is that when judgment overwhelms love, that's when evil enters into the world. So I think the key here is that we need to make our observations, stay in touch with our compassion, and know that choices are being made all the time.
Hear, hear. Something I have been meaning to ask you now for about 2 hours, and it keeps getting blown out of my mind.
Uh-huh.
Your website, you had a website up. Do you now have one up?
Yes, I do.
The address, please.
Okay. The address there is a little bit like yours. It's just www.kevinryerson, K-E-V-I-N-R-Y-E-R-S-O-N, .com.
Okay. Was there a website up that was a different one that went down?
Oh, it's, you know, on occasion what happens is it's just like with every website. There's occasional tinkering going on by either by the webmaster or occasional tinkering with it by the actual server, per se. Some people were giving accounts that, you know... that
even occasionally outside evil forces.
Yeah, exactly. Occasionally, I think that the deity harasses me through my website every now and then.
I'm not sure, Kevin, who it was who said this to me, but I thought it elegant at the time, and I've been contemplating it ever since. You know, the... theoretical physicists of our time talk of something smaller than a quark that went kaboom and became everything that is, the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else said to me, well, you know, I think the Creator was at once the only thing that was. There was not time, there was not space, there was not anything. There was the Creator, and this deity was lonely. And he literally blew himself up, creating all that is, and he is indeed within all of us. And I thought that rather elegant.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that I am too far off from being centered on exactly the idea. My belief is that, let's face it, if we reduce ourselves to the fundamental particles, we're all energy. And that's a remarkable description of whether it's biblical or Eastern of what we call spirit. Or
yes,
consciousness.
Exactly. I thought so. All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Art Bell and Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
So this is Eric in Boise, Idaho.
Yes, Eric.
And I just have a comment and kind of a question. My comment is, I kind of think, you know, I kind of agree that we're moving into this change. I mean, it's totally obvious in the last 100 years. I mean, we have magic at our fingertips. We have synchronized explosions that propel us in these chariots of fire we call cars. We have... you know, we got electricity that comes from water. There's fire, water. I mean, we have all the elements manifested at our finger. I mean, we have the capacity for paradise on Earth. But yet, I mean, I don't know. I just don't understand it. When, I mean, if you were a being of light from another galaxy and you came to this planet above it and just sensed its vibration, I mean, it would be like a universal joke or a cry, one of the two. You know, so I just don't know. I mean, the Bible says the work of men's hands is gold, and I guess the streets are paved with gold. you know?
Interesting.
Just the way I look at it, it's like, I mean, if you look at the last 100 years, 100 years before that, 100 years before that, it was all pretty much the same until the last 100 years. We're just moving into this new vibration, and then, you know, this consciousness, this higher force or whatever, people associated with, you know, various forms of nature and science and stuff, you know, inventions manifest. We got, you know, we got the car, we got the Wright brothers, they had the right idea. I mean, all these inventions were for a basic need. They were for, you know, to make our lives better, not, you know, now look what we got. You know, it's just, I don't know. It's, I mean, my question is, do you think that if somehow, if the media figured out or looked in the mirror, the media figured out actually what they were doing and what they were creating. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, the media says this and says that and says this, and then it's like our society acts like that. It's like, I don't know, it's like every internal thought is magic because it affects external action.
Yes, the media rarely, if ever, looks in the mirror, and they do it very timidly when they occasionally do very, very timidly. Now, in defense of the media, they're only providing that which there apparently is a market for. The violence, the gratuitous sex, and so on and so on. All of that, there's a market for, ratings-driven, money-driven, makes the world go round. So the media doesn't frequently get introspective. They just look at the bottom line. That's the way it is, Kevin.
It's intriguing because the media always has these statements where they'll say, you know, your advertising dollars can influence millions of people. And then simultaneously they'll advocate it going, no, we're just giving accounts of what's occurring, and the media has actually no influence on, you know, general behavior whatsoever. And yet Madison Avenue spends millions of dollars to do exactly that. And one of the things it's pointing out is that originally we did seem to have a much more profound consciousness in the media. Edmund Morrow, for instance, is considered one of the true icons. You might consider him the Joe DiMaggio of the media.
Of course.
And that we have drifted away from the emotions and the values that drove him to use the media as a consciousness-raising tool.
Is it an inevitable thing that occurs as you simply get too big? I look at companies. Small companies are spry. They take risks. They make fast decisions. They can move quickly. They're lean and mean. And it seems like the larger a company gets, the more bureaucratic it becomes, until finally it passes some sort of point and it begins to be inefficient. And that continues until it's either goes broke or it restructures completely.
I think you're correct. It obeys a very organic law. I mean, it's no more complicated than looking at the growth of a crystal.
The cosmic Peter principle, I believe.
I think it's a good way of putting it. You know, maybe Peter really does have the keys to heaven on a cosmic Peter principle level.
That even nations and governments eventually rise to a level beyond their own competence.
That's correct. There is an internal corporate wisdom. It's a very small minority school. Folks like Ben and Jerry's kind of live by it.
Right.
The Body Shop lives by it. Whole Foods lives by it. And their whole idea is that when they reach that certain epic cycle of getting too big, their whole thing is that they try to see what they can do to spin off into new industries that are completely self-contained entities in themselves and start that growth cycle all over again.
Yeah, in a sense, blow it up and begin it again.
Exactly. So I suppose the general principle is that the minute you realize yourself, the minute you realize that you're some aspect of the deity, blow yourself up and start all over again.
Mm-hmm. First time caller line, you're on the air with Art Bell and Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hi. My name's Sue, and I'm from Kansas.
Sue, you're going to have to yell at us from Kansas.
Okay, I'm from Kansas.
Right.
And I had a couple thoughts and a couple questions.
All right.
Have you ever considered that, you know, with the way the ozone layer is and they're seeing lightning coming from places they've never seen before, that it's just our sins are reaching into heaven?
That's quite interesting. In the Middle Ages, they used to think that comets
where maybe the sins actually reach in what they call the ethers and were sparking the end of the world. But one wag pointed out, well, you know, there's so much sin in the world that the whole atmosphere would have caught on fire by this point in time.
Yeah. And also, it's like, I believe that this is the time for us to be okay. And like the first time our parents ever let us watch ourselves instead of having a babysitter, it's kind of like God saying, okay, this is your chance to prove to me that you love me because you love me. Not because you have to and it's the end time, but it's our chance to do what we're supposed to do in this world on our own instead of being babysat.
I think it's another intriguing insight. The book of Revelation talks about that there's a period of time where there's four angels that hold in abeyance the events described in the book of Revelations.
Mm-hmm.
And some people feel that we're in that period of time, that maybe that we are becoming God's adults. And by observing, you know, our behavior, we're in a period of time now where maybe we can exercise free will in an adult-like manner and set aside a lot of the negative consequences that are obviously occurring on the planet at this time.
Yeah. Also, too, I did this drawing. I kind of like that guy that does the insight thing with the drawings. I forget what it's called. But there's been times I've just sat down and started drawing, and there's this one that I couldn't figure out for a long time, and then one day I was sitting there thinking dark and light, and I looked up and the moon was out, and it was the fingernail type one, and that's what that picture was. And for some reason the thought occurred to me that the bottomless pit could be there. They always talk about the man in the moon, and have you noticed the face that you can see in it here lately?
Mm-hmm.
And all the, how many moons have we had so far this year? Two each month.
That's interesting. You know, it's the idea about signs of the time. Some people even went so far as to think that the bottomless pit, with what we now know from physics, might even be black holes. That, in other words, if light can't escape it, is it feasible that consciousness can't escape it? So these are interesting interpretations, and in many ways that's the beauty of some of these prophecies, that they're metaphors that stimulate both emotional intelligence and thinking.
So fascinating. Something so attractive, like a black hole, that not only light, but consciousness as well could not escape it. Woo, what a concept.
It is. It's really one of the more intriguing ideas. Fortunately, there are some studies that suggest that the consciousness may travel faster than the speed of light. They've done experiments with telepathy where information was broadcast, say, over the radio, and the information was broadcast by telepathy, and it apparently got there ahead of the radio broadcast.
Well, there were actually a couple of astronauts, I know because I've interviewed them,
mm-hmm.
who conducted experiments on the way to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And claimed some success, as a matter of fact. So that may be so.
That's true, and it has extraordinary implications. You know, maybe right now in the future, Art, there's some reincarnation of us sitting there actually verbally saying nothing, but just sort of like broadcasting to millions of people through telepathy.
Hold on, Kevin. We'll be right back. We're going to take a break here at the top of the hour, refresh ourselves, and dive back in for one more. Kevin Ryerson is my guest. He's one of our nation's greatest intuitives. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you.
call Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
That would be the place, and we are the people. Good morning, everybody. Kevin Ryerson is my guest, and we're about to get underway for the final hour this night. And he's a good guest, isn't he? Stay right where you are. Back now to Kevin Ryerson. Kevin, you've done very well. You're hanging in there very well indeed.
Oh, I'm trying. If Casey said these are the most psychic hours, I guess this should be my setting up shop.
Well, then here's a good one for you. Question by fax for Kevin. Kevin, what is your purpose on Earth?
What is my purpose on Earth?
That's what he asks.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I'll personalize the question. I feel that my particular purpose is to help people do exactly that, is to help isolate what is considered to be their dharma, their personal purpose, something that I refer to that springs out of their own talents, is something they love to do, and so therefore is self-sustaining. It's what in Buddhism they call right labor, and that's what I feel that channels do. There's been a tendency for people to focus a lot on what is my karma or what is my life lessons, to the point where they have made so many judgments about themselves to where they feel there's these almost overwhelming burdens to overcome. Where its twin word dharma is means the energy that does the work. And the dharma is the real purpose, the real service, the real enlightenment that the person is here to experience. And that is something inherent within them to be of service to themselves and other people.
All right. Excellent. Here we go. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Good morning.
Is that me?
That's you, all right.
Hey, I can't believe I got through.
Where are you?
Hi, Art. This is Debbie from Vallejo,
Hi,
California.
Debbie. Right.
And I have a question and also a question for you, if that's okay.
Sure.
Sure. I sent you a letter and a couple of faxes about a request I had for you to interview somebody, and I wonder if you got them.
That's so generic that I can't possibly answer.
Well,
that.
I sent you a package about Meher Baba and Bal Kalchuri.
Oh, yes.
And I wonder, did you get that?
Yes.
And would you be at all interested in...
On the list.
Pardon me?
On the list.
Oh, wonderful.
I do have a lot of...
to hear that.
So, yes, I did. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Well, I wanted to know... I wanted to thank you for your guest because he's saying so many things that touch so many points, both generally and specifically about areas of spirituality that I believe in and also that... resonate with things that Meher Baba has said, and I wanted to ask your guest, does he know about Meher Baba, and does he have any feelings about this avataric age that we're in?
Yeah, I've heard about Meher Baba. He was always one of the more intriguing entities, per se, on the planet. He almost looks like one of those old silent movie stars or something.
Jerry Colonna, right?
And his whole thing was is that he had a dharma almost like a... Mother Teresa, in a way, and going to a place where he felt that people were suffering the most intensely, including places like asylums and things to this effect, because he felt that's where joy was needed the most.
Mm-hmm. He traveled extensively around the world.
Yes, yes, yes. I believe he was a contemporary of Yogananda, for instance.
Well, he claimed to be the avatar of the age and ascribed a lot of the acceleration of consciousness
mm-hmm.
with all its attendant good and evil and
mm-hmm.
all the things that Art calls the quickening to
mm-hmm.
be the result of the
mm-hmm.
advent. And I wondered if you had any comments about that.
Well, you know, there's debates going on whether or not we're entering a new age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the idea that maybe we're coming out of what is called the Kaya Yuga, which was a period of darkness. The Hopi prophecy spoke of a 400-year period of darkness that they feel we're coming out of. And, you know, what I like is that I once heard it of above all people defined nicely by Oprah Winfrey, where she said that avatars like Jesus came here not to teach us about their divinity, but to teach us about our divinity.
Exactly. Beautiful. Yes, I completely agree
mm-hmm.
that it's within us, ultimately. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Art, and thanks for having your guest, and I really hope you'll get in touch with me and that you'll take the opportunity to talk about Bob on your show someday.
You've got it.
Okay?
Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Hi.
Yeah, is that me?
That's you in a truck, it sounds like.
Yep, I'm a truck driver.
Just a guess.
I just had a couple comments to make.
Sure.
I've got this January 18th issue of the Time magazine.
Right.
And it goes to say they government knew about the problem since the 60s, the Y2K. And in 1967, the House orders the National Bureau of Standards to settle the debate. And under pressure from the Pentagon, the Bureau sticks with a two-year digit. Then in 1993, curious nuke launchers at NORAD turned their computer clocks forward to January 1st, 2000, and the ICBM alert system crashes. And then if they, about 6 weeks ago when I was at home, I was watching the satellite, and I was watching the Senate hearings, and they were debating on a bill on the limit liability.
That's right, for Y2K, and they still have not passed that bill.
They haven't passed it?
No.
Okay.
No, it's still all clogged up. They can't decide to limit liability. And I would imagine that's probably the attorneys lobbying to keep everything wide open because they're going to be the winners. I've sort of thought over the years, Kevin, that eventually attorneys, by percentage, will own the entire world.
That could very well be. I don't know. I like the attorney's joke that came out in Philadelphia, where they, what is it? What is 10,000 attorneys chained to the bottom of the ocean? A good beginning.
A good start.
But I say that with all lightheartedness.
No, most of them are really good people. But really, when you think about it, as litigation continues and continues,
mm-hmm.
and they keep taking a percentage and a percentage,
mm-hmm.
Finally, they win everything.
It's true. You know, the interesting thing is that there are attorneys that realize that the adversarial process and litigation, they feel, is consuming the society to such a degree that they almost feel as though that there will be nothing left. It's creating all these bottlenecks. And there's actually a group of attorneys referred to as a Society of Holistic Attorneys, and they are now advocates of what they refer to as negotiation resolutions rather than litigation. And it's the idea that they work privately with parties to bring about a mutually agreeable resolution that then in turn becomes legally binding on both parties. In other words, there is a resolution process, and they all sign off on it. But they want to start seeing themselves as negotiators or arbitrators.
It's astounding.
Rather than litigators.
Holistic attorneys, what a concept.
That shows that there really is, some light creeping into that dark room we were talking about.
Yeah, before. It's a little like hitmen going to church on Sunday. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Me?
Yes, you. You.
Oh,
you.
Well, good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Where are you?
I am a Buckeye as well.
All right.
So, great. And I only have 37 questions.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But I'll narrow it down. First off, I think that I've sort of had an inner knowing all my life of the laws of life, but about 20 years ago, I really started synchronistically running into things that would awaken me, like a little aha now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And, but every once in a while, I feel like I'm on the Monopoly board, and I go to jail, and I can't pass go and collect $200. But is the enlightenment, I guess, or awareness, what percentage do you feel, Kevin, is in the United States and also worldwide? And because just trying to exist... in the everyday living, mm-hmm. it's hard to think about mm-hmm. the things that you really need to concentrate on.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize when you do that, life does become easier, but then we get caught up in the mm-hmm. quagmire of everyday mm-hmm. life.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but my question was, like, how do you see American society versus mm-hmm. worldwide society in this growth of enlightenment?
Okay, well, I think I can answer that. A lot of people who are spiritual people have ceased to think of themselves as being in the minority, and they've started thinking in what they refer to as the majority world, which, for instance, the majority of the world believes in reincarnation, you know, as a fundamental principle. They believe in things like prayer, meditation, and they believe that collectively, you know, that they can eventually be synchronistic with each other, but we're still looking for the common language that allows us to concentrate on the things that are worthwhile. Demographically, in the United States, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is
right.
one of our premier holistic think tanks, founded by Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut,
right.
has come up with what they refer to as the demographics as of the cultural creatives, and these are people who are looking for what they call authentic psychic values. And the belief there is that there is 45 million of these people who are now thinking this way in the United States.
You're kidding.
Now, and so we're not alone. And the bottom line is that as to what to concentrate on, you know those ahas that you got?
Yeah.
You know those moments of
enlightenment? I love them.
Yeah, you see, my whole thing is that if you wake up with that aha, that's the pitch. That's the pitch pipe that's going to tune up your whole inner orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is the music that you're going to play all day long. In Buddhism, they say that when you experience joy, let the event fall away and preserve the joy.
Right.
So rather than going out and looking for event A or B or C to make you happy, just go ahead and remember that aha moment and make that your meditation. That's what you focus on. And then everything else will begin to revolve around that new nucleus.
Hmm. Do you travel around and give seminars, et cetera?
Oh, yeah. I travel extensively. I was just in New York a few days ago.
Hmm. I presume if one got on your website, they could find out your schedule.
Absolutely.
Also, how does one easily learn their dharma?
Well, you know, your dharma is really inherent in your talents. It's the thing that you do well, you love to do it, and so therefore it is self-sustaining. And that might initially be a hobby. It might be a social service you do. But it gives you so much energy, it almost sustains you through anything else you might want to endeavor to do.
So you almost don't have to hunt for it. It should be obvious to you. It should be instinctive.
It's what in Buddhism they refer to as finding the diamond in the mud.
All right, ma'am?
Yes.
We can't go for 37. But,
I know that.
Right. Thank you and take
thank
care.
Thank you for having Kevin.
You bet. For me, Kevin, it's radio. Instinctively, intuitively, I've always known that. One time I actually tried to run away from it, and I was miserable. Oh, I was miserable.
Mm.
And so I finally one day had my own little aha. Now I know why I'm miserable, and I came back, and everything's been all right since.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I have 38 questions.
Oh.
I have just a couple of three questions.
All right.
First of all, it's really a pleasure speaking with you, Kevin. I've read a lot of your stuff and aware of you through Shirley MacLaine stuff.
Mm.
And I wanted to tell you, Art, that thing with the crop circle, it's a member of the Rockefeller family that's going to be putting up the money for that.
Well, that it would almost have to be that, wouldn't it?
Bill, yeah,
we're talking
there's
billions.
There's going to be an endless amount of money.
Either that or Bill Gates or somebody.
Yeah. Let me see. The second question I wanted to when you both sort of agreed on in the creation of the universe and God creating the universe, have you ever heard of a statement, I separated myself
from myself in order to become myself, instead of thinking of God as exploding and being some person, you know, being an infinite mass and then exploding, but of separating myself from myself in order to become myself.
There's some Kabbalistic mysteries that talks about, as well as there's some very ancient Egyptian texts when talking about the creation deity Amun, that talks about that. In fact, in the Kabbalah, there's some very intriguing notions in the idea that God chose to actually withdraw from the physical world as an act of love in order to give permission for the creation to occur.
Kevin, don't you think that it's really not a good thing that people should think of God in terms of a gender, as far as being a father, a man? But
oh, you mean
in
the sense of gender? Well, I think that it's a unique tool that, let's put it this way, the Old Testament deity, it's acknowledged even amongst many Kabbalists and many Jewish mystics that the Old Testament deity, in relationship to, say, in the story of Job, appeared to be very wrathful and very distant, even though there were beautiful passages and poetic references to how personal the deity was. And then when Jesus began to use the metaphorical reference of God the Father, and the God the Father being within, many people felt that poetically restored like a family-alike and personal relationship with the deity, making comprehensible the psychic and emotional makeups that are alluded to in the deity in the Bible.
Okay, also,
I think it has its uses.
It's very interesting that you keep on going to Kabbalistic things, because I studied with some with Kabbalists, and being born Jewish, all four of my grandparents are Kohanim.
Interesting.
And my great-great-grandfather was the Rebbe of Riga Latvia and risked his life every day to teach the Torah.
Fascinating.
And I had learned that another thing I've never heard anyone say, everyone says Jesus, but historically he was never called that. That's not his name. His name was Yehoshua,
mm-hmm.
and Joseph and Mary, son of Joseph and Mary,
mm-hmm.
Hebrew name Jehovah.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus was an abomination that was created in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I never hear anyone using mm-hmm. his correct name.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is Yeshua.
Yehoshua.
And there are many different, you know, Hebrew terms, you know, that have come to be, sort of like, shall we say, anglicized over the years, per se. And simply put, I think the name has come to be anglicized, you know, probably through the King James Version of the Bible. And Jesus, in my opinion, was a brilliant rabbi, you know.
Ascended Light Master.
Mm-hmm.
Another quick one. Peter Hurkos. Did you know him? Hurkos?
Yeah.
Peter Hurkos.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know him?
I know the name.
Amazing psychic. How about
mm-hmm.
George Anderson in Long Island?
Yeah.
He does fabulous work. And Art, it was so good last night to hear Richard Holguin's voice.
Yes, wasn't it?
Oh, my God, it made me feel so good. He sounded so good.
He's really on the rise.
He's a phenomenal person.
All right.
Phenomenal person. And thank you guys, God bless, okay?
Thank you, my friend.
God bless.
And good night. Here's where we'll break at the bottom of the hour.
Only fools rush in, and I ain't here falling in love with you.
Gotta be my favorite version of this. Good morning from the high desert. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Romance in our hands, heaven's holding our hands, moon is shining just for us.
Richard Bell in the Kingdom of Nye. From west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
It's a nice night in the desert. Beautiful out there. Good morning, everybody. Kevin Ryerson is here, and looks like he'll be here through the end of the program. By the way, if you want a copy of this show, you can get one by calling 1-800-917-4278. Once again, Kevin Ryerson. Kevin, hi.
Hi.
They await your presence.
Okay.
So many of them. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name's Lori. I'm calling from WLS in Chicago.
WLS.
Okay. First of all, I want to ask you, Mr. Bell, what is the name of that Egyptian-sounding music that you play sometimes on your show?
There are several pieces. They are by Lorena McKennett, who is Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no music like it in the world. I'm in love with it.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Ryerson, a couple of people beat me to this asking about life purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But now I've known for a very long time, I might say over half my life, what my passion was and what I've always wanted to do, which is an entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had any real success in doing that. But yet that feeling that this is what I'm supposed to be doing does not leave me for one moment.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be that I'm blocking myself in some way, or is there some, or am I just...
No, that's a very interesting question. In other words, very interesting. Kevin, in my case, I was extremely lucky or fortunate or karma was right, or, you know, who knows what's a line out there, but I am doing exactly what I want to be doing. For other people like this lady, her life is driving her in one direction, but it is not working.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what it is that it's the way the talent expresses itself. For instance, in a way, just being on the show here, there's a certain entertainment value that has to be in every program.
Absolutely.
In fact, there is now a whole movement called edutainment, synthesizing the word education and entertainment. And I suppose as a person who's interested in entertainment, the classic advice of finding out who your audience is and then sticking with them is one of the things to adhere to. One suggestion is sort of like visualize the range of entertainment the person might want to enter into, and then begin to, by meditating on it, see what series of synchronicities will begin to occur that reinforces the direction that the person wants to pursue. It's sort of the Taoist strategy that says that rather than looking at your career or your work in entertainment like a mountain that you have to climb and exhaust yourself, think of it as more like you are in a valley and then the mountains bring you everything that you need.
Well, you know, pretty interesting. I know that in order to get a message out, you have to get people's attention. And I recall so many of my teachers in early years in school, they just bored a person to tears. I mean, I was driven to watching the clock tick on the wall instead of listening to what they would say. But then occasionally you would get a teacher, like my fifth grade science teacher, who was just absolutely astounding and made everything come alive, grabbed your attention, grabbed your brain, and then sort of educated at the same time. Entertained and educated, and it all, boom, 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 worked.
Correct. And actually, you're almost quoting a case history that there was a person who had the ability to entertain, and eventually what they discovered their dharma was, is that, and who their audience was children. Per se, and that by synthesizing their ability to entertain, which they considered initially the
antithesis of intellectualism, when they synthesized the two, they really became one of the best noted teachers in the educational field. And, so, and that, again, to me, is that restoring that emotional intelligence that we're talking about.
So maybe that's what that lady needs to look for.
This could very well be. It's a matter of finding the audience she wishes to entertain. And the very term entertain means to focus a person's attention.
There you are. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Art. This is Karen in Houston, KTRH 740 AM radio.
Hi, Karen.
How you doing?
Just fine.
All right. I know that in some of the readings I've done recently on Edgar Cayce, he said the most important thing anybody can do right now where we are in this place that we're in is to realize our purpose here. And when you read a little further, you understand that he breaks it down, that you have to learn the difference between personality and individuality, and a whole lot of just getting out of your own way kind of helps.
I would agree. There's an excellent book put out by the Edgar Cayce folks. It's called Edgar Cayce Stories of Attitudes and Emotions. And it's a very, very powerful work for people, in particular readers of the Edgar Cayce material. But the material is broken down so succinctly that almost any reader, whether you subscribe to spirituality or psychology, no matter what your beliefs, you could find this to be an extraordinary volume as a way for coping, you know, with the future shock we're dealing with, coping with these times of testings, you know, that Cayce spoke of in this 40-year period of history that's coming to a climax here in the year 2000. And it's an extraordinary work.
Yes, I've read some of that. I haven't quite finished that one just yet, but you're right about that. It will touch you very deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I want to ask you, are you familiar with Tuesday Lobsang Rampa?
Yes. The Third Eye, for instance?
Yes. And I understand that in some of his writings, he has written about the giants who walked upon the earth before.
Mm-hmm.
And just a whole lot of things about information that has been retained by people like himself, monks and others.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done this through generations and generations. And it ties in with extraterrestrials and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any updating or bringing forth of more of this information?
Well, there's a wonderful person by the name of Situ Rinpoche who is a currently living monk. He's fairly young. I think he's like just entered his 40s.
Uh-huh.
And he's a member of what is called the Kayayuja lineage in Tibet. It's one of the four Tibetan lineages. And he heads up being a mentor to what is called the Karmapa, who would be the equivalent of the Dalai Lama, that lineage. And he was teaching one day, and one of his students stood up and says, "You know, teacher, as the as the tales about Shambhala, it speaks about that there are wheels that come out from Shambhala and test the earth, that there's the silver wheel that goes out to see what the karma of the planet is, and then if the karma of the planet is high or good, the gold wheel comes out and brings a golden age. But if there's negative karma on the planet, the iron wheel goes out and the lords of karma incarnate, and humanity must suffer the consequences of its karma."
Is that kind of like a cosmic Punxsutawney Phil?
A what?
Punxsutawney, you know.
Yes. Exactly what it is. It's a matter of whether or not the lords of karma see their shadow or not. Whether or not we'll have six more weeks of winter. But in that, He then began to ask Situ, you know, he says, you know, "Do you feel this is relevant to UFOs?" And the teacher himself, he goes, "I sometimes wonder." He goes, "That's a good question." So the ancient myths and the ancient story keepers, this knowledge, they are very, very keenly aware that there is a holistic linkage between these times, extraterrestrials, and that knowledge indeed is becoming more forthcoming.
All right, and Cayce mentioned, too, that if America does not wake up,
mm-hmm,
and become more like what you're talking about to bring forward a golden age,
mm-hmm,
that, as always, as it's been shown in history, civilization will die out and move westward.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to maintain what we have and improve on it, then we just need to wake up, don't we?
I think so. My private joke to you would be is that with China supposedly raiding all of our scientific secrets and everything, they appear to want what we have to move westward, being that China's the first thing we sort of get when we get there. But on a slightly more serious note, I would have to say that I'm hoping that 45 million cultural creatives, citizens here in the U.S. who are beginning to wake up, that if we, one of the most materialistic of societies, have the ability of creating the ability to destroy civilization, perhaps it's, as Barbara Marx Huber said, we have an equal capacity to create an entire new civilization.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Art, thank you for your forum. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, and good night. Have you been to China, Kevin?
Myself?
Yes.
No, I haven't. I've been to Japan extensively, and I have an extensive number of Chinese national clients, and I've had invitations to go to Hong Kong, but I have not yet been to Chinese mainland.
You should go to both. You should say, I've been to both, and I think there was never a scarier experience for me than going up into the pseudo-economic areas of China. And then further on up into Canton and so forth. It's frightening because you realize that they are now rapidly moving toward what we were and will rapidly move so far beyond us, given enough time, that we will be forced in the end, and I know this sounds terrible to most Americans, but we're going to have to either join them or they're going to pass us like a Ferrari going by a guy with a flat tire. It's that serious. It will impress you very seriously. It's a trip worth making.
I think I'm going to have to add to my sort of like planetary experiences. So that one goes on the roster.
Yeah, all right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question and a comment. Well, sort of a want to get Kevin's take on something.
Okay.
When you speak on all these different philosophies and disciplines, Eastern and biblical, perhaps the best thing that I haven't heard anybody mention is that truth is simply universal in every one of these disciplines. Every one of them talks about having a creator and a plan, a purpose, that sort of thing. Good karma, bad karma, just like our parents who say, if they taught you about Christianity, talk about God kept his little book with gold marks and black marks and so on. Well, some Eastern religions believe in building up good karma, bad karma, and perhaps maybe, I just want to get your take on this, the easiest thing to connect all of those for people to really realize is that truth is simply universal, no matter where you're at.
I agree with your comment.
I expected a little bit more feedback.
Well, a little more feedback would be is that I have a favorite story. It was about a Buddhist monk. Actually, he was a Zen master who had never read the Christian Bible before, ever. And so he had a student open up the Christian Bible and read to him, and basically the student just randomly opened it up and turned to the phrase that says, "Consider the lilies of the field, neither do they toil nor they spin." And yet Solomon, as the king, was never adorned such as these. And the Zen master thought a moment, contemplated it, and then turned to the student and said, "I like that. Whoever said that is very close to Buddhahood."
I did have a comment for Art.
Sure.
Have you ever heard of the Global Biological Assessment?
No.
Look it up. It would be an interesting comment, a conversation piece for a later show.
All right.
As far as political and just completely, I know that you're into the government conspiracy thing. Go to the UN website and check it out.
I'm not really into a government conspiracy thing. Really, I'm not. You know,
I think that
what's going on with government is what goes on with large corporations. We talked about it earlier. I think that these entities eventually, as they get big enough, reach the level of incompetence, pass it, and just keep on going. And we're long past that right now with our government. So I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's like a law of nature.
Well, I didn't mean to use the word conspiracy. How can I put it? I know that you're fond of saying that our government likes to keep things from us. And
it's how they look. How does a government get its power? It gets its power by keeping secrets and by taking your money.
Well, look it up. And
all right.
I think you'll be interested.
All right. Thank you very much. West of the Rockies, as we close out here, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson.
Hi, Art. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
It's really great listening to your wisdom and knowledge. My point sort of segues into two of your previous callers about purpose and Dharma. About 6.5 years ago, I was living in a community in Scotland called Findhorn.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a very clear message saying, you've completed your preparation, you're ready for your next steps, we want you to go to America. And that was it. No more information. So I've been in America for 6.5 years. And of that 6.5 years, I've been trying to work out what was my point, what was my purpose for being here.
Mm.
And talking about Dharma in your program tonight, it makes me realize that it doesn't have to be anything super. It doesn't have to be anything like having a radio show or anything like that. It is basically what I'm discovering it is. It's just being where I need to be and doing what I need to do on any specific day. And there were times when I think I'm wasting my time here. There's nothing really purposeful about my being in America. And yet so many times I've been in the right place at the right time to help so many people in so many different ways.
I think you've hit on what's called the rabbi's gift. First of all, Findhorn's one of my favorite places on the planet to visit. I enjoy lecturing there. And I think I can count David Spangler amongst some of my peer group, per se.
Mm-hmm.
The rabbi's gift is that it's a story that's told where there was a rabbi who lived in the woods close to a monastery. And members of the monastery, their order was dying. So they went to visit the rabbi. And they broke bread with him, and the rabbi talked about the difficult times in the synagogue. And suddenly, the rabbi had a revelation for the monks, saying, well, the only thing I can tell you is that one of you is the Messiah. And the monks, suddenly being aware that one of them might be the Messiah, pondered who it might be. And they thought, well, you know, it might be so-and-so, because he's always there when you need him. Or it might be the abbot, because he's the most wise. But not knowing which of them it might be the Messiah, they started treating each other with more and more respect, just in case one of them might be the Messiah. And that was the rabbi's gift. I think we need to treat each of ourselves as though we just might be the Messiah.
Excellent. We are so short of time. Kevin, if you were to recommend something that you have written as a first item to read to find out more about Kevin, what would you recommend?
Well, the Shirley MacLaine books kind of are sort of a primer on what it is that my work is all about. And they're such a complete journey in and of themselves. I always encourage people to look at that as kind of a self-adventure. And, of course, the book there to begin with is Out on a Limb, which is
okay.
Where Shirley, you know, described her adventures with yours truly.
Still generally available in bookstores or by order, special order?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And there is also several books that I'm represented in my work. There's one called The Channeling Zone by Michael Brown. And then my own book, although it is currently out of print, it's called The Soul's Path, or Spirit Communication, The Soul's Path, and that still is accessible through Amazon.com.
Oh, excellent. We'll get a link up to that.
Great.
And we do have a link to your website right now, and I presume just about everything is in your website one place or another.
Right. I like to look at these websites or cyberspace as the new collective unconscious. So, you know, it's working 24 hours a day to help bring resources to humanity, or the sort of the Akashic records of the 21st century.
Boy, there's a whole nother discussion. The Internet. Well, all right. What a wonderful program, and what a wonderful guest you have been.
Well, thank you, Art. I've enjoyed being on the program. Thank you.
We'll do it again. Kevin, good night.
Good night.
Well, there you have it, folks. Kevin Ryerson, what a great show, huh? We're going to turn this microphone over to Peter Weisbeck tomorrow night and Monday, and I hope you will welcome him with open arms. It'll give you all an opportunity for some diversity, and I think you'll find he's a fascinating, alert guy with lots of energy. That's Peter Weisbeck. As for me, That's it, and I'll see you this coming Tuesday. It's been great. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night.